I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna...
I'm Tierra Campbell from Franklin Magnet Middle School. Welcome to our journey, stories of desegregation and community in Champaign-Urbana. 50 years ago, Brown versus the Board of Education made segregation in public schools illegal. While there was no law in Illinois prohibiting African Americans and Caucasians from going to school together, there was segregation across Illinois and in Champaign-Urbana. We faced de facto discrimination in jobs, housing, and in public schools. Six other students and I interviewed a dozen local African American adults from age 40 to 91 to learn about their childhoods, educational experiences, and expectations, and their role models. This radio program will provide a window into what it was like for African Americans to live outside of the educational system while living within it.
I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna hit 'em, hit 'em.
Although African Americans and whites coexisted in Champaign-Urbana and attended integrated junior and senior high schools, we endured segregation in daily living. We were discriminated against when we went to buy a house, eat in a restaurant, swim in a public swimming pool, go to a movie, and look for a job.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. I say we bring more than a paycheck.
Our journey begins in 1937. That's when Mrs. Irma Scott Bridgewater, who's 91, graduated from the University of Illinois with a degree in sociology.
What was your first job when you graduated out of college?
My first job was a maid at Newman Hall.
What got you into that? Were you pressured into it?
Well, I looked for a job and couldn't find any, and that my mother was working there at Newman Hall, and I felt like I had to help repay my parents for the money they'd spent for me to go to school. So I got a job there and worked, I think it was a couple of years. I didn't want to leave town. I didn't want to leave Champaign. I don't know whether because I was scared or what, but I never wanted to leave. I always wanted to stay here.
What were some experiences being a maid at Newman Hall?
The thing I guess that bothered me most was there was a woman there that was head of it. Well, I think it was $1.60 an hour we were making then. And every time I got my pay, some of the money was gone. It seemed that she would take some money out of it because she figured that she was teaching us. That part always bothered me. And she let my mother go, and I don't know why she thought I'd stay there after she did that. But I quit.
My sister finished up here at the university, but she couldn't be hired in Champaign. They hired her down in Morris Brown College because the university had an arrangement that was they would send them down to Morris Brown College. But even earlier than that, I had an uncle who finished in engineering, but he had to teach math down in St. Louis area. But you had to go to an all-black school or an all-black college to teach at that particular time.
What do you do for a living now?
Well, I have this little barbecue pit that I've had for a number of years.
Is this really what you wanted to do?
No, this is not what I really wanted to do. I wanted to be a chiropractor. And I went to school and I finished chiropractic. And I never did get my license because coming up at that era, going to school, the chiropractic schools did not accept American Negroes.
I had applied at the phone company here in Champaign, right out of high school. Knew I knew everything and could do this job. Could not get hired in Champaign. Subsequently moved to Chicago, got hired in Chicago. 5 years later, I'm back in Champaign as probably the second black supervisor at the telephone company.
I had more education than this guy, had more experience working with children, mm-hmm. and yet and still he was hired for the job because he was white and I was black. To give me a remedy, they hired me, but as his assistant, and he pulled out a gun and held it up when I'd asked him for a tape measure, and that was to frighten me. And he said to me, "I'm going to get you." After pulling out this gun, I said, "When you get me, you better make sure you get me good." So one of the things that I made up in my mind a long time ago, I will not, under no circumstances, allow someone to discriminate against me when I know that it's not right.
This is a mean world to try to live in, to try to stay in until you die. This is a mean world to try to live in, to try to stay in until you die.
Without a good job, it's hard to find good housing. African Americans were steered into some neighborhoods and away from others.
I don't understand, I don't understand, I don't understand.
When we first, the first house that we bought, they would tell you in a minute that there was a gentleman's agreement that they wouldn't sell you a house anyplace else but in certain areas. And they would, at that particular time, they were bold enough to come out and tell you that that's the way that it was. You know, and so you had to either go into certain neighborhoods or you had to find somebody, a private homeowner, who would sell you a house individually without having to go through real estate agents. And I mean, that's the way that things were at that particular time.
Everybody around me lived in substandard housing. So you took for granted that your house was okay. I mean, I lived in a house that was set right on the ground. We had rats. I don't mean mice. I mean rats. I grew up in a house with my aunt's children, and they were bitten by rats. These were things, substandard housing in Northeast Champaign was a given. Thank God we had a fire in that rat-infested place, and it burned down. None of us were hurt, but it allowed us to move to a different house. When we moved into Birch Village, that was the first time we ever had indoor plumbing and running water. That was the first experience for us. There was segregation. I just did not realize it at the time.
I had white friends at the time I was at Champaign High School, but none of these kids lived in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We only saw each other at school. And I had white friends. When I say friends denote a lot of different things. I didn't go to their homes. They didn't go to my home. We would sit at the same lunch table. We may talk to one another in class. We may walk down the hall speaking to one another. But we didn't visit one another. Our communities were separate.
Used to be the dime store right down here on Neal Street. Mm-hmm. You go in there and you could eat. It had an L-shaped counter like this. Like on that end was where, like the colored kids had to eat when you go down the dime store, down that short end, and there was no seats. Mm-hmm. But down this end, where all the seats were for the white kids in town. And yet we went to school together. Right. And so that's how that worked. No, you didn't like it, but you lived with it.
We went to the movies. We sat in a certain area. But I thought that's because that's where all my friends were, and that's where we wanted to sit. I had no idea that we couldn't sit anyplace else. So it was subtleties like that that were in this community that your parents didn't really talk about.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Champaign has had the same kind of history that all places had, such as the Ku Klux Klan burned a cross on our lawn two times that I can remember, and one time when I was a little child, and my dad, who had fought in World War I, said you can do that out there as much as you want to, mm-hmm, on the street, but when you come across the lawn. I've got my sharpshooter's medal, and, you know, somebody's got to go because I'm protecting my family. And so I guess maybe I was sort of raised up with that kind of pride, and so I always felt like, you know, my family always said you could do whatever you want to do, and they would be there to back us.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
According to Kathleen Slate, who grew up in the 1950s, African Americans at that time knew their place and didn't rock the boat. But that was about to change.
Then the Martin Luther King movement started in the South, and we kind of jumped on the bandwagon at that point.
Back during that time, I would say probably around 57, 58, or maybe later, Champaign-Urbana was not integrated. It was still segregated. And one of the things that had happened is that during my teen years, African Americans were not allowed to sit at the lunch counters here in Champaign and Urbana. So I was part of that movement where we picketed W.T. Grant's, but also J.C. Penney's. And picketing J.C. Penney's was because they would not hire African American employees. And one of the things that happened during that time, where we had the sit-ins, we had the marches, and I was spit on and called the N-word, which was not necessarily nice. And I was one of the first persons to be hired at Jewel T, which is Eisner's, whereas it was to integrate that position. So that was a lot when you're talking about integration and you being one of the trailblazers, that you've got to take things and sometimes hold things in that you wouldn't necessarily like to people to act that way toward you.
The J.C. Penney store locally was located in downtown Champaign. Although there were a lot of other department stores down there, most of them had at least one African-American working there. Now, don't get me wrong. It was not a glamorous position by any means. They were operating elevators and running vacuum cleaners and that kind of thing, but at least they had some on the payroll. J.C. Penney had none. So the very first church-organized political movement that I remember was a boycott of J.C. Penney in downtown Champaign.
From Mobile, Alabama to Nashville, Tennessee, Denver, Colorado to Washington, D.C., there rose a cry for freedom and human liberty. Oh, come along, my people, and take a seat with me. Heed the call.
So Bethel Church was the place that they met and did all of their strategizing under the leadership of some very, very active ministers, not only from our church, but also from a church called Salem and Mount Olive. The ministers of all three of those congregations were very strong advocates. So our church was right in the midst of all of that. And also our church worked with young people on campus. As a matter of fact, my great uncle worked out here and developed relationships with the black students on this campus, and actually had them coming to Bethel Church. They had an orchestra. He got them connected with resources in the community so that they could make a living, because most of them had to work while they were going to school.
And so they had a room with all of the resource materials for the black students, and the black students would congregate there. They had all of the black books and black history, and that's where the students came to study and to, they'd feed them in the on Sunday evening, and that was their social outlet.
And a lot of those people are now judges. Well, no, they're retired now, but a lot of those people were very influential people in the city of Chicago once they left here. They all spoke fondly of my uncle. So all that happened through Bethel Church.
I African-American parents were encouraging their children to be all that they could be. However, African-American children often received different messages in integrated schools.
We were given our schedules to take them home, and the parents would help us with our schedules. Well, they would tell us not to take college preparatory courses. They didn't say it that way, but they would say that we couldn't, they didn't feel like we could pass algebra or geometry. And my parents had decided I was going to college, so they always signed up for me to take those courses, and I took French too. And I passed it. I have no great shakes, but I did pass it. But they didn't encourage us to take college preparatory courses.
There were some counseling issues. They were pushing us to take home economics and the sewing classes, the cooking classes, the child development classes.
It was suggested at the time that we take classes like typing and home ec. Those are the kind of, and maybe that was some racism that was subtle, because I wasn't aware that they are telling me or subtly saying to me, Catherine, you're probably going to be a housekeeper or a secretary. You know, so you need to prepare yourself for these kind of things. Take home ec, take sewing, take secretarial classes.
What they thought was best for us was shop. And the same thing for the sisters was the best for them was homemade. So we disagreed with all of those, and we challenged them. And my example with that is my sophomore year, my first class of my first hour every day was German. Never did very well in it, but my point was, is how dare you tell me what I cannot take?
They'll actually let you pick your courses, which they know you didn't know what you were really doing, but you were setting yourself up a lifetime of failure if you didn't take the required courses and took the advanced courses and stuff like that. Wouldn't really preparing you for college or for any higher learning.
That was just kind of the way things were, but I don't believe that I ever felt like an individual teacher, for whatever reason, discriminated against me because I was African American. That experience, I don't think I had. I think it was more the collective decisions that were made at that time that just kind of overlooked the fact that we were there.
This is a mean old world.
You're listening to Our Journey, Stories of Desegregation and Community in Champaign-Urbana, featuring African-American residents ages 40 to 91. I'm Tierra Campbell. Across the generations, our interview subjects shared stories of the difficulties they faced as racial minorities in integrated schools. Mrs. Bridgewater lived in South Champaign in the 1920s. She and her brother were the only two black children at Lincoln School.
During games, nobody would want to, they wouldn't want to hold my hand. But the teachers understood the problem, and they would find some other way to solve it. Some games I played, some didn't, some I watched. Of course, being a child, you just play with whoever will play with you, and you just go on from there.
We got put out because they said we were making a spectacle of ourselves at that sock hop. And, of course, what we were doing, we were dancing what they called the jitterbug back at that particular time, and all the students came and gathered around. And I guess they said we were making a spectacle of ourselves because everybody was gathering around, and so they called us to the office, and we got put out of school. My dad brought us back and said, nope, can't do that. And so he was always one that sort of stood behind his kids.
Didn't too many go out for football in high school. Mm-hmm. So I decided I was going to go out for football my senior year in Champaign High School. So the guy went to Les Moyer. I said, Les, I said, I'm coming off of football this fall. And he looked at me, he said, a lot of times you get a lot of hurts, you know. He said, you know what? You're going to have to be twice as good as the white boy to play now. Mm. I looked at him. I said, I'll play. Mm. So when school started, I was starting on the first team. I did the kicking. I did the running, whatnot. And so it was one other kid on there. We went down, another Negro kid. And we went on a trip to West Frankfort. I had never heard of it. And let me tell you, dear, when I got off of that bus, they looked at me and saw me, and I would try to get back on that bus. Man, what they were calling me. I couldn't get back on the bus. The other kids were coming off. And so, but we had quite a time that night. And that was just one of the incidents.
We had music appreciation where we learned who the composers of the music was and so on, the whole string of things about a piece, and then the teacher would play just a part of one, and we were to write down what it was and so on. We had a contest there at Lincoln School, and we had perfect paper, and went on to the next stage, which was from where all the different schools were together. And anybody who passed that was to go on to the state. But the only mistake they found on my paper was they said I had an extra hump on a M. And maybe I did, I don't know. But anyhow, I wasn't allowed to go. And of course, I always felt like there was another reason why I didn't get to go.
I was a good student in school until I had eighth grade, and I had math. In my math class, it changed me. I went into Miss McGinney, and we had long division, and we had fractions. I went in the room. She said, Arnold, have a seat. I said, okay. She said, what do you want? I told her, I want to ask her something about this fractions. She said, okay. Three little white girls came in. I'm sitting there, she's gonna help. And they start talking to her. She put her arms around them and started talking and walked away from me. I sat there and waiting for her. She never did come back to me. And everything I had built up for love of people just sort of vanished from me. Mm-hmm. It really did, because from that moment on, I never was good in math. Everything else, I was good in school. Not math. I just could not get over that, what she did to me in that math class. I never could understand. I always held math as the cause. That was the culprit. You know, but it really truly wasn't. But this way she did, Miss McGinney. Never will forget her.
I would love to be a cheerleader. We as African Americans were not afforded that. Now, the boys could play basketball and those kinds of things, but as far as the girls being able to do that, that was not the case. I never saw a black president at Franklin.
In the school system, my first exposure was seventh grade. It was like overwhelming. You know, it was something that you had never seen. You hadn't interacted with them. You hadn't been in gym class. You didn't take showers with them, so that was pretty much the first exposure.
As a ninth grader, I participated in what was considered to be an elite vocal group called Vocalettes. It was for freshmen. There had never been black students in Vocalettes until our class got there. And the Vocalette instructor chose myself and two other black students to join that group because of, I guess, hearing us in other choirs. And they took a trip. I got sick and couldn't go. But the other two girls did go. They had some terrible experiences. They were not allowed to enter the hotel through the front door. They were not allowed to eat in the same restaurant with the rest of the people. They had to take their food through the back. So, yeah, there were some very definite, not so positive experiences with that.
My brother, you know, he came out at 16 because he couldn't take it anymore. And the way that they treated him as a black male, and the way that Edison Middle School dropped them in the lower level of the school, in the basement, in the corner, with all the other black males. And it was a thing so that he could not take, day after day, the degrading. He could not take it. So when he wanted to learn something, he'd come home and he'd want me to help him because my education was on the first floor or upstairs, and his was on the lower level with one teacher who supposedly had all of these bad boys that couldn't learn, which absolutely was not true in the case of my brother. Because much of what he was able to receive in education was after he got home and we sat down and then go over his homework. Then I became his teacher. He got a job at 16. He worked as a cook, did it for years. He worked construction work. But whatever he did was honest work. But he needed to have the peace of mind in order to be able to function. And he couldn't get that in public schools.
Are there any teachers that you felt really discouraged you when you were growing up in the middle school, Edison?
Yeah, I had one teacher. I'd rather not mention his name, but we used to have Black History Month. And they would always, from grade school all the way through junior high school, we talked about the same people, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, George Washington Carver, and a few others, but they never had brought in the real black history. And my sister was a black history major, and I brought some books in to school because he told us to bring stuff from home. And when I brought it up to his desk and showed him, he knocked them on the floor. And me and him had a little scuffle, and from then that probably changed my way I looked at education.
The reason my band teacher had an impact on my life is because he took an interest in me, and he put me in places where I could either fail or succeed based on my own talents and my own merits. So I was able to rise through the ranks musically because he saw that in me. And I can remember us going to what they call music contests. They had them at least twice a year, and you'd get these little ribbons for the work that you did, depending on how well you did it.
I wasn't quite prepared to go into middle school as I should have been prepared. And when I got into an integrated school setting and questions that were being asked of us, I thought the whites were more prepared to answer those questions than I was. And when I thought about that, I realized that they may have came into the classroom a little bit more prepared than I was prepared.
So you thought that white children were a little bit more prepared than you were?
They were.
Well, what caused that? Did they have better teaching or did they have better homes? What caused them to be more prepared than you were?
They had a better community from which they came from. They had the facilities in that community that we did not have. We did not have churches that had auxiliary rooms where kids could study. We didn't have libraries. We didn't have recreational facilities in which these kinds of activities could go on. As I said, we were 22 in a two-bedroom home, so we clearly didn't have quote-unquote study space in our house. We ate in shifts. I was, I think, 19 before I ever slept in a bed.
Which school experiences were life-shaping or life-changing for you?
Well, none of them, except probably my first year at Urbana as a junior, when I took a test, and I did horribly on that test. And one of the retiring white teachers asked me to stay after class, which I did. And she went over the test and just showed me how horribly I did on the test and reminded me that I had very little time left in school and I needed to get myself together if I was going to be able to do anything as an adult.
How did that make you feel as a person or as a young child?
Well, it made me feel that I had wasted all of my educational experience and that I had a very little time to make up. And I set about trying to make up that time as best I could.
Mrs. Hester Nelson Suggs was a principal at Booker T. Washington School for 22 years. Before that, she taught at Dr. Howard and was the first black teacher at Leal School.
When you were a principal or a teacher, did you notice a different attitude or the way the younger African-Americans felt between the differences between Caucasian and black?
I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think so, because I can go back and look at the successes. I think it's the expectations that we have of kids and that we have of teachers. There's no teaching going on if there's no learning going on. And if you don't know how to teach a kid, then somebody needs to give you some pointers on how to do so. And I don't think there's a kid who doesn't want to learn. You know, sometimes we kill that learning spirit of our kids, or sometimes we can't recognize the learning spirit of the kids. You know, I've had some kids that come to school, the teacher says can't learn math, he can't learn reading. Hey, he could write me 3 or 4 pages, maybe as a second grader, the difference between a nickel bag and a dime bag. You know, but if he can do that, and if he can weigh and measure, I can show her how this is a learning situation, and how do you take that situation and capitalize on it and turn it around and make a kid really want to learn? You know, because they're going to learn something. Some of them are going to learn because of us. Some of them are going to learn in spite of us. And I think it's the because which makes a teacher a teacher. And if you can teach kids, you can teach all kids. And if you can't teach all kids, then you need to go back and refine your learning process, because if you can't get it as an adult, how can you expect a kid to get it as a kid?
How long? How long? How much more long? How long? I wanna know how much more longer is I just gonna have to wait on you.
You're listening to Our Journey, Stories of Desegregation and Community in Champaign-Urbana, featuring African-American residents ages 40 to 91. I'm Tierra Campbell. Before the Brown v. Board decision made segregation of public schools by race illegal, black children in the southern U.S. were bused miles from home to go to black-only schools instead of their neighborhood schools. In Champaign-Urbana, the policy was that children attended their neighborhood school. But many neighborhoods were racially segregated. Busing was used to change that.
When our school district and most of the school districts across America responded to Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, what our school district did was they tore down all the inner city schools. They tore down my beloved Willard Lawhead School. They built schools outside of our neighborhood, and they forced the children that were in our neighborhood to attend those schools. So their children would not have to come into our neighborhood to attend schools. So all of the school siting and new constructions that have occurred over the past 40 years all occurred in the southern part of our community at a time in really which there were no housing. When I was a kid, Cary Busey was built on agricultural land. Southside was built where there was no homes. These schools were all built in undeveloped subdivisions, and later on the homes grew around them as a plan to not allow white kids to be bused into the black community to have an integrated school system. The strategy was simple. If we were to be integrated with them, we would have to come to their neighborhood to experience this integration. This occurred not only in Champaign, it occurred in Urbana, it probably has occurred in every urban school system in America.
I don't understand, I don't understand, I don't understand, I don't understand.
At that time, it was thought to be a positive, but as I look back at it, I think we need to re-examine how positive that was, because really what ended up happening, the black schools, although they didn't have a lot of resources, had teachers who knew and cared about the students that they were teaching. And once those schools were closed, the best of those teachers were sent across town, and the students who formed a part of that community were dispersed throughout the rest of Champaign as well. And we really haven't recovered from that yet.
And it was just really odd to me that they were able to go to school in their community, but I had to be bused. But I just figured as a kid, that's just the way that it was. I didn't really question it a lot. I think at times I would ask my mom why, or I had issues with being the only, as I got older, the only black girl, or that I was the only black in a class or in a particular activity. And so as I got older, I became a lot more aware and began to ask questions. So it was a very interesting experience, and it's something where, yes, I learned a lot, but it would have been, I think, nice to have been able to go to school in my own area and not to be bussed out necessarily.
I guess I had mixed emotions about busing, because the kids in Washington school, you know, things that we don't really talk about. My dad was a custodian at Washington School, and we don't talk about the presidential scholars and the doctors and the lawyers that came out of Washington School when it was an all-black school and we didn't have the busing.
Basically, my children at that time were bused purely for desegregation, not for education. They wanted to go to Buttonfield because we need this number over here. And that's why they were bused. And I continue to say that, purely for desegregation.
We didn't care to ride on buses, and a lot of times the bus drivers were not very nice to us. We didn't like getting up a half an hour earlier or hour earlier. We felt like they were not very acceptable and responsive to us when we went to that school. We felt that arrogantness of the rich kids out in Southwest Champaign that were there, where their moms and dads had bought them cars. We didn't necessarily care for the treatment that we were receiving because we were being bused to Centennial and not having the choice to go, because we lived in the north end of Champaign, so we felt like, why did we have to go to Centennial? We should have been able to go to Central. Now, we were fortunate in one aspect of it because it was a new school and we had had opportunity to go to an air-conditioned school, swimming pool, all of those components were there. So that was the plus.
I think it would have been a good thing if they had showed us what had more black teachers and more black people in with the integration part, instead of just taking the kids and shipping them to a whole new environment, and all you would see was the whites. Teachers and everybody's authority, no one you could really come to. I think I had a black PE teacher and at Southside, and there was a black cook there. In Edison, they had like janitors, cooks, and I think we probably had four black teachers, five black teachers out of all Edison. And today it's about still the same.
It's up to us now, because we have the access, to make sure that we have a level playing field. By that I mean, if my kid wants to go into algebra or trigonometry or other kinds of things, that the availability is there, whereas before the availability wasn't there. Before, say, the schools in the black neighborhoods and things, you might get books that other buildings didn't want. You know, and now everybody has to at least have the same new textbooks and the same new kinds of entree to education. I think desegregation is good, but I don't think that's the panacea to everything. You know, because the educational opportunities are there, we should be availing ourselves to them, but we should also make sure that that all good teachers, I think every school should be a good school.
Across the generations, local African Americans told us how their parents and their community supported them.
In all black schools, we knew the teachers, teachers knew the parents, parents communicated on a regular basis with teachers. If you didn't get good grades, they wanted to know why. We were nurtured a good deal.
Actually, I can remember my mother, this happened in elementary school, my mother is the one that taught me my times tables. She just went over and over again doing that drill and practice with flashcards and all of that because I was having some difficulty there. So she was engaged with us in that way.
It just made you feel ashamed if you didn't get good grades. I mean, we had a lot of pride in what happened at that time. I remember crying when I got my first D.
Did your parents have any expectations for you? High expectations?
I don't think, if they did, they never shared that with me. They just always encouraged me to do my best, to be the best that I could be.
I am from a family of 13 brothers and sisters. We lived in a two-bedroom home. At one point, there was 21 of us who occupied this home in the northeast area of Champaign. I came up in the 40s. In fact, I was born in 1941. I came up at a time in which you did not question your parents. You did exactly what they told you to do and when they told you to do it. There was never any debate. There was no television to offset my mother. We had one telephone. We were not allowed to use the telephone. We didn't have all the outside distractions that kids have today.
I grew up without parents. My grandmother was my provider. She of limited, very limited education. She could not read. She could not write. I would read her mail to her. I would write a response to her mail for her. It helped me to enhance my reading skill. It helped me to enhance my writing skills. You know, helping her helped me. But she could not, the guidings that I need and what to do, or if I got stuck on something, she couldn't do it. And I'm sure that probably bothered her more than I would ever have known.
In my case, I lived the majority of my life, young life, with my grandmother. My mother lived in a different community. My grandmother had an eighth grade education. Her sister had a sixth grade education. These were people who didn't have an opportunity to go to school. Their feeling was, you have this opportunity, you take advantage of it, and you're there to achieve. That's what we expect you to do. And it was unacceptable for anything less. I had my first child when I was still in high school, but it was never a question as to whether or not I would finish high school. That was just a given. That's how we grew up. You can count the people on one hand that we went to school with that did not meet that challenge.
There were some that felt that I wasn't smart enough to be in a particular math class, or that I should be in a particular science class or a writing class. And so my mother and I, at times, we had to challenge the system because they'd be like, well, she can't do the work. And my mother would say, well, how do you know she can't do the work? And she's going to be in this class, and she is going to do the work, and she's going to pass. And so my mother would make sure that when those situations came up, and she would challenge the school, and I would get in that class, and I would work, and it would be challenging at times, but I did pass. But a lot of times my mother had to be the advocate on my behalf for my education, because if not, then I just would have been another black student just going through the system. A lot of my black friends, especially my male black friends, that just got passed through the system.
Nina's right. I did have to go in and raise some issues and some concerns, some eyebrows, and you know, some people saying certain things were happening that I knew was happening. My work through a social service agency to work with kids, work with teachers, to work with administrators, school administrators, I knew what they was looking at. I knew, because I knew how they was treating my clients. So I was determined that I was not going to have my children and even the kids that I was that I was working with as much as possible to not have to go through a lot of trauma every day because they were part of something that society say you must be a part of.
What people helped you to shape who you are? Did you have any certain role models?
Yes, I did. I would say that it was my grandmother. Her name was Amy Chipman. She was, I would like to say that she was a businesswoman, that she would take laundry and do laundry in her home, and she had a work ethic that she would work very hard. So I think my grandmother and then my mother was a role model because I saw how my mother would take in children, take in people who did not have what we had, and she was always willing to share. And she, too, was a person, I wouldn't say stingy, but she didn't let people play with her money. If you're older, you had to pay her. her money, but she accumulated houses and was able to become an entrepreneur in her own right, being able to do that. And then my father. I think my father, my mother, and my grandmother were really my role models.
There were all types of individuals in our community. There were entrepreneurs. There were, of course, ministers. We had African-American teachers, and that was males and females, principals. I went to an all-black school when I first started out. So there were so many different exposures that we had, and so you could choose your idols.
I remember one lady named Maggie Bell Johnson, who lived down the street, who used to play ball with us, and your neighbors helped raise you. If you acted out, they would check you. I think that it was a community effort to raise the people in our community.
Boys and Girls Club showed us how the characters and helped us with our homework. They got us tutors. We had like field trips, showed us different things, you know, like going to baseball games, football games, the museum. Showed us a lot of things that we didn't really get to learn in school.
There is a balm in Gilead.
Going to church, and then they used to have, like, on Sunday evenings, at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, they had what they call BYPU, Baptist Young People's Union. And the kids from all the churches would meet at Salem Baptist Church. That's when you get to see your girl, I guess. If you had one, one of those things. And so that's where we'd be down there. And all the kids would meet there. That's on Sunday evening. That was it. They had no place, no joints, or nothing place like that to go. So you'd be there. And you'd be talking about music and things, but everybody be right there at Salem Baptist Church in the evening. There's so many kids at the time, and we all got on as a community. It taught us a lot of things. Of togetherness. That's what I saw. That's what I really saw at the church. A lot of togetherness with all the kids because we were all poor at the same time. We just depended on one another.
We begin our journey with the story from Mrs. Irma Bridgewater, who despite a college degree in 1937 could only get a job as a maid. When she became director of the Douglas Community Center in Champaign a few years later, she faced a different challenge.
I was coming to them not knowing anything about recreation, and I was from the other side of town and with a degree, and I just was not accepted because I was from the other side of the tracks and all that, and had been to college. Had a degree. The way they treated me was an advantage in the end, and I was glad because it made me realize that I had to learn how to get along with people. It was a good lesson, and as I said, I had to swallow that degree and forget that I ever had it. I swallowed my degree and got along with everybody after that.
If we look at where we are as a people, African-American children, it may be worse now in many ways. And I only say that, and it's hard to generalize. When I look at some of the reports that I'm reading, mm-hmm. where African-Americans have the highest suspension rates in the schools, we did not have that before. When I look at the number of African-Americans who cannot read, I didn't see that before. When we look at the number of African Americans who are, or young people I'm talking about, are disrespectful to the elders, we did not have that before. So I think with some things we've lost. Right now, you don't have as many black role models that you all can look up to as we had before. We saw the black teachers, we saw the black doctors. You've got some that's in the area now, but if you look around, do we really have that many African-American professional doctors and lawyers and those kinds of things? I think we've lost some ground, and even with businesses in Champaign and Urbana, I think that we lost.
How long, how much more long, how long, how long, how long, how much more long.
You're listening to Our Journey, Stories of Desegregation and Community in Champaign, Urbana, featuring stories from African American residents ages 40 to 91. I'm Tierra Campbell. What's it like for African Americans in the public schools today? Here's what some of us think.
Back then, we didn't have as many opportunities as we do today.
Tamika, do you feel this way about this?
I think that we're better off today than back then. But like Veronica said, we still can improve on a lot of things. But the things that's improved, it don't seem that way. Don't like that much. Like the school, people don't act like they want to be in school like they should. But, you know, we still got a lot to improve on, and I think that we can
okay.
do it.
Tamika, do you have a role model in life? And if so, who? And also, tell me about your role
model. I don't really have a role model, but my goal is to go to college because I got, like, people around me saying that I'm not going to make it to college because it's in my blood. But no, only a couple of people in my family has graduated. But the more people around me tell me that I'm not going to make it, it's the more that I want to make it. And that's what's going to get me up in there to be a lawyer.
Do you believe that people down you and make fun of you because you're well-educated?
Well, I get a lot of comments from seventh graders at Franklin. African-American seventh graders at Franklin because I act quote-unquote white and because I'm in the honors classes and everything. And I think that some, like, I really kind of just ignore it and go on with my life because I just need to concentrate on myself and I don't think they need to worry about me.
Tamika.
Just the other day, somebody told me that school was for fools, so they say, and that school ain't right. But, you know, and they put me down, and I study got people putting me down. But like I said earlier, it's making me stronger to be who I am. And I feel like I know how Catherine Hognum felt when they was put down by the counselors and said to take low-course jobs because people around me keep telling me it's not right and, you know, it's better to drop out because where you gonna get when you go to school? You can't get a good job while you're in school, but I believe different.
Why do you think that kids these days say you're acting white or something like that? Where do you think that came from?
I don't know where it came from, but I think that kids today see it as if you ain't yo-yo man or if you ain't what they call a thuggin' or what they say, pimpin' or something. If you ain't doing that or getting bad grades and hanging out and cruising, trying to be popular and wearing Sean John or FUBU or basically ghetto. If you ain't ghetto, then you selling out. But I don't think that's right to judge a person because of how they act and tell them that they selling out or stuff because it's like judging a person by his skin color. It's not right. We've been through this project, all of us together.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that you're ready to be a role model at any time? Or if it's somebody that needs you, do you feel that you can be there for them and, you know, tutor them and mentor them and help them through their problems?
Since I've been through this program, I believe I've gotten more educated than what I was before. And I feel that anybody who, like, if they wanted to write a paper about a famous black person, anybody come to me. And, I mean, I can help them with the facts, the years, the dates, anything. Because this project, it's expanded. It's helped me be more educated than what I am, and I've learned more than what I've known before. So, yeah.
I believe that I would be able to tutor somebody or help them, because I've learned that all role models are not perfect, and I know I'm not perfect, but I've learned to surround myself with different people, and I've learned to adapt and understand what they're saying. And I think that if I help somebody else, that I'd be able to help them and learn from them too.
Jessica? I agree with what both of them said, but I just want to add that if someone wanted me to help them with something like this, I would want to do it a lot, because I learned a lot and I have a lot of knowledge about all of this stuff, and I want to share my knowledge with others.
Okay. Me, personally, I think that I can be a really good mentor or a role model for somebody, because all that I've been through and all that I'm going through and the steps that I gotta make it, and I feel that I can teach a person, you know, to be strong, and, you know, the best has not come yet, but, you know, you still got the good times. You got a whole life ahead of you. So, yeah.
Well, we got to wrap up our show about the Brown versus Board decision, and I just want to say that some of the answers that you guys gave were very good, and people need to listen and take these answers that we said into head, because they're very good answers, and they need to think more about their education before trying to be out there, trying to be the best, impress their friends and anything.
Like the saying, go books before boys.
I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna stay on the battlefield. I'm gonna stay on the battlefield till I
We hope you've enjoyed our journey, stories of desegregation and community in Champaign-Urbana. This program was produced by Jessica Austin, Yakira Barbie, Tierra Campbell, Deanna Carr, Tamika Lee, Veronica Martin, and Markeisha Moten from Franklin Magnet Middle School. We conducted the interviews and edited the stories with guidance from WILL. Stories were contributed by Nathaniel Banks, Irma Scott Bridgewater, Catherine Hogue, John Lee Johnson, Martell Miller, Hattie Polk, Dr. Nina Patterson, Yvonne Ridgway, Kathleen Slates, Hester Nelson Suggs, Fanny Taylor, and Arnold Yarber. For more information on this project, visit our website at will.uiuc.edu. That's will.uiuc.edu. We'd love your feedback to our program. Please tell us your reaction by calling our listener comment line, 217-333-0853. That's 217-333-0853. Our journey was directed by Kimberly Chronic, co-director Dr. William Patterson, visiting assistant professor U of I, technical instructor Dave Dickey, assistant producer Shawan Williams, Franklin Magnet Middle School teachers Shamim Rakai and Kathleen Carroll. Website designed by Jack Brighton. Music by Sweet Honey and the Rock. Special thanks to Franklin Magnet Middle School Principal Sandy Powell. I'm Tierra Campbell.